One of our recent Australians of the Year, Dr. Fiona Stanley, co-authored a book recently called Children of the Lucky Country. In this book, Fiona Stanley raises some serious issues about the way our country is developing and some of the implications for the way that we raise children in this country. At the beginning of the book, she talks about what is known as the modernity paradox. The modernity paradox has been observed in a number of countries around the world, mainly developing countries. And the modernity paradox goes like this. In one hand, in many countries, we seem to have attained a material life like never before. More money, better houses, greater education, more technology, more opportunities, and more travel. And yet whilst we have this in one hand, in our other hand, we have more social problems, more anxiety, more depression, more eating disorders, and more relationship breakdown. How can it be that it seems that with one hand we've grasped hold of life, and yet with the other hand, we seem to be losing it? We've been long told that economic prosperity is the rising tide on which the good life is to be enjoyed. And yet now we're seriously questioning that idea. We are living in challenging times, I'm sure many of you agree. And so we need to think very carefully, very clearly, honestly, what is central to life and what is peripheral to life, and especially at Christmas? Christmas, for many people, indeed, is a paradox in itself, where tables are full of food, gifts overflowing, but lives that are empty. And it concerns me that many people are reaching and running for the good life, and it seems, in fact, that they're just picking up the crumbs under the table of life. And so very briefly tonight, for a couple of minutes, I want to remind us as Christian people, in the busyness of our lives, what indeed fills us. I want us to eat, to dine, to banquet on the rich truths that come from God's word. I want us to taste and see again that the Lord is good. And I'm just going to point out a couple of things that come to us from that reading from 1 John chapter 4 today. I want to serve up, if you like, two courses. A main course, a little bit longer, and a little bit of dessert to follow it. This letter from John is well qualified to talk about Christmas, it seems to me. Being someone who's a scientist and an engineer by background, I'm always looking for people who are well thought out, who are reasons, who look for the evidence, who explain things clearly. And John at the beginning of his letter says this, "We are testifying to something that we have seen and heard and touched." Jesus. He indeed is qualified to talk about Christmas. He saw, he heard, and he touched. And so here are these two ideas. Firstly, a main course. If you're following along, chapter 4, verse 9, John says this. "This is how God showed his love amongst us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him." As Gavin mentioned, I have a wonderful job. It's a great privilege to be employed to help people in a large school community understand the Christian faith, and we have people at all ranges of the spectrum in terms of their understanding. Often when I'm meeting with families, I will ask them, what do you know about the Christian faith? Regularly people will say to me, well, I think it's about love. They might even say that I think it's about God who loves us and we're to love one another. And then I'll often say to them, how do you know God loves you? And what does that love look like? And so often, sadly, there's little that people have to say. Here John, who saw and heard and touched, explains very clearly how we can know about God's love. He said, "This is how we know God's love. God sent his Son. The key to life, the key to love, is looking at this sending. Now, we all want to know what God's intentions for us are. And indeed, this natural, this beautiful world that God has created gives us clear evidences of a creator. But it's Jesus who is the climax, the ultimate proof that there is a God and what his intentions are for us. I enjoy a game of golf. About a year ago, I played a few weeks in a row with a man who came to Australia from another country on a boat as a refugee. He turned up in Australia and he literally had nothing but the clothes on his back. And he worked hard. He worked 7 days a week, eventually running a little shop for many, many years, for long hours. And he said to me, it was only when I came to Australia that I heard for the very first time about Christianity. And one of the astonishing truths that he first heard was this idea that God is a Father who loves us. Now, for those of us who have grown up in this country, who take for granted saying the Lord's Prayer, we say it so often that sometimes I think we forget how profound that is. For many people who have come from different countries, grown up with different worldviews, this is profound truth. Christmas is God's intention to clearly reveal his love in sending his Son. The purpose of the sending, John says, that we might live, we might have life. Indeed, the key to life and to love is to look at this sending. But John goes on in verse 10 with a bit more clarity. He says, this is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us. As human beings, we seem to know that love is somehow important to life. Of all the surveys that are done asking people what it is that they want above anything else in life, the number one response of all surveys is that people want to be loved. As we listen to the songs on our iPods and on our radios and in our cars, the number one topic of all songs that have been written is love. Of all the poems that have been written, it's love. Indeed, of most of the movies that we watch, love. But if we listen to those songs and those poems, why is it that so many people keep asking, what is love? Where is love? Why does love seem to escape me? Well, here is the definition. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us. See, the reality is that we human beings aren't good lovers. Despite what people might be saying and singing and writing, human beings are actually lousy lovers. Let's be honest. Simply look at the statistics about marriage and de facto relationships. The incredibly high breakdown. If two people who think they're compatible struggle to live for any length of time together, what hope is there for families and communities and nations? But John reminds us that if we're lousy lovers, God is not like us. God doesn't love us because we're good lovers. God doesn't say that he'll love us when we get our act together because we'll never do it. We're not good lovers. By nature, we're so self-focused. Even with all our education, our material prosperity, our homes and our travel, we look at this world in which we live and we realise it's not in good shape. And at Christmas, above any time in the year, we should be realists and rationalists. But John goes on, this is love. Not that we loved God, but he loved us and sent his Son as a sacrifice. What John does here is put Christmas and Easter together, and we must keep them together. God sent his Son. Why? As a sacrifice for sins. It's a package deal, the whole truth, the big idea. Yesterday I was down at Kirribilli going to a function. I walked under our beautiful Sydney Harbour Bridge, and I was reminded again as I walked under the bridge how big those pylons are that hold that magnificent bridge up. one on either side of the harbour for which the bridge spans. Christmas and Easter are like those two pylons, God's plan for eternity that holds up for us the proof that He is there and the offer of forgiveness that comes through His Son. Not just coming to talk and to do the miracles, but to die, that we might be forgiven, that as John says, that we might live. But there's one further truth that I want to remind you of that John points out here, a little bit of dessert. Not for the sweet tooth, but a sweet truth. In verse 18, John goes on to say this, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment." So much of this world in which we live is driven by fear. It's true that fear in some circumstances and some contexts is useful. But relationships built on fear and lives built on fear doesn't work. Last week I had a young couple in my office. They had relationship difficulties and I was trying to help them work through it. And as I listened to that young lady who had already been through one broken marriage and was now in her second one and struggling, I asked her if she'd been seeking some help. And she said she had. And I asked her what she'd learnt as she'd got some help. And she said, "One of the big things that I learnt is that for most of my life, I've been living by fear. I've been raised in a home on fear. On the outside, a beautiful house, neat gardens, plenty of money, car to drive, education to have. But my life was built on fear." I read a couple of weeks ago the recent report that came from the Australian Psychological Association. The latest report, every couple of years, about how Australia is doing on the issues of stress and well-being. And the Australian Psychological Society is reminding us that it's on the rise in this country. One of the things that they reported on is this thing called FOMO, fear of missing out. It's scary, isn't it? The sad irony is that whilst young people in Australia today are more connected than ever, they're more fearful than ever. When it comes to knowing God, many people relate to Him out of fear. They do strange things. Why? Because they don't know that perfect love that drives out fear. If you had met a man that I met not long ago called Ahmed, a Muslim man, he would tell you that he's striving every day that he wakes up to do good deeds for fear that he'll not be received into paradise when he dies. But it's not just out there. It's in churches. I also met a lady recently who I was chatting to who was very diligent in her religious zeal, attending services, praying, lighting candles, giving money, doing her religious deeds. But when I asked her why she was so diligent, she said, "Because I am afraid that if I don't, I'll never get to heaven." And the sad reality is that many people sit in churches and still don't know this perfect love. Here is this beautiful truth that John, in his old age, wants us to know. He wants us to know God's love and to be set free by His perfect love. It's not that we're perfect. We never will be. But we can be forgiven when we know and experience God's love in all its fullness. I'm reading a book recently by a man called Dan Allender, talking about the wonderful news of being a Christian. And he said this, "A stunned and grateful heart is free to love because it's been captured with the hilarious paradox that we are unlovely but loved and free to try without condemnation." What an amazing God we have who loves us. And that perfect love can drive out fear. The modernity paradox is a salient, sad, and indeed a challenging reminder that humanity needs answers. The 21st century is being unveiled as an era of insecurity. Despite all our advances, we seem to have no security and no hope, and fear is dominating the horizons of many lives. Being children of this, the lucky country won't satisfy. But being children of the loving God will satisfy eternally. And so at this Christmas time again, around our trees, enjoying the wonderful fruit, product of God's good creation, and opening our presents and getting our Bunnings vouchers and new socks, this truth, this reality should drive us. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son. And it's this perfect love that drives our fear.